I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, welcome to Dwell, a Searcy Institute podcast for homeschool moms by homeschool moms. I'm your co-host, Renee Mathis, and I'm here with my other co-host, Karen Kern. Hey, Karen.
Hi, Renee.
It's good to be here. We are actually recording in the Searcy office.
We're all together.
In one room. It is glorious. But before we start with today's podcast, I'd like to thank our sponsor and tell you a little bit more about Inquisicook. Are you searching for hands-on activities that explore the practical side of science? Look no further than your kitchen. Inquisicook blends food science and culinary arts into an engaging program that puts delicious food on the family table. Let Inquisicook do the teaching with lesson videos that speak to the student in a friendly conversational tone. Their online platform is easy to navigate and optimized for mobile, so the learning experience can move from the classroom to the kitchen without a hitch. They provide the recipes, instruction sheets, and student forms for every lesson, so there are no books to buy. And their instructor resources make assessing student progress a piece of cake, even for the busiest parents. Inquisicook was created by homeschoolers for homeschoolers, and they're passionate about turning curious students into intuitive cooks, not just recipe followers. Say goodbye to the tyranny of the ingredients list and say hello to utilizing what's in season, what's on sale, or what's in the fridge. Visit inquisicook.com to view sample lessons, then check out the recipe gallery to see just how crave-worthy science can be.
So I get to introduce our guest today. I'm looking right over there at Buck. We have with us today Buck Haller. Buck is an employee at Searcy, and so we get to work together, and he is an apprenticeship head mentor. You have an apprenticeship group, and then you also do the Latin apprenticeship, right? And he runs our consulting division at Searcy, and he does all kinds of things, and we wanted to talk to him today because you might know, you might not know, that Buck used to be a rodeo cowboy, and he has a great name. Buck Haller, for a cowboy, right? But now he is a Latin scholar. So we wanted to have him on today so we could talk about how, first of all, your story, how you went from a rodeo cowboy to teaching Latin and working for Searcy, and give some encouragement to the moms of boys who wonder if they're ever gonna get, you know, out of the trees and out of the dirt and into their books. And I forgot to mention also that your wife, Rochelle, and you have three grown daughters and some granddaughters. Two granddaughters, right?
All daughters and
granddaughters. All daughters. Yes. So, welcome. Yeah, so, first of all, tell us your story, how you got here from...
Sure.
From where you started.
From the ranch.
From where I started. Well, I grew up in California and I can come back to that. But eventually my education, once I decided, well, I left California when I was 18 to go to Texas. At that time, I was in high school rodeo, and my junior year in high school, I made it to the California State Finals. So every state in the union has a high school rodeo association. And the state's usually broken up into districts. And so during the year, you have competitions within your district. And then usually the top five cowboys in each event go to the state finals, and then the top four at the state finals go to the national finals. And so my junior year, I made it to the state finals. It was in Bakersfield, California. I grew up there partly when I was a kid. And then my senior year, I made it to the state finals again, but I actually was a top three. No, well, I scored third in the state of California my senior year and went to Gillette, Wyoming. And Gillette was where they had the national high school finals. And so from Gillette, I left California, Red Bluff, where I was born. I had a 79 Chevy Love. threw everything I had in there. And drove out to the, I stayed part of the summer in Nevada working on a dude ranch outside of Wells, Nevada. And then I went from there to Gillette, and I was there for 2 weeks during the rodeo. And drove down to Texas because I moved to Dallas to go to a welding school. And instead of going to college, I went to a trade school. I was going to be a welder. I'd welded all through high school.
Can I jump in and ask you how your academics were in high school? Because you were like riding a rodeo and welding. Were you also doing your reading and your writing and your math?
My freshman year, yes. After that, well, I did really well. It's all the way up through 7th and 8th grade, and I was in American Legion. I won the American Legion Award when I was in 8th grade, or it was given to me, whatever. And then my principal in middle school had set up all my classes when I went to high school. At this time, I was living with my father because my parents were separated, divorced. And my father was working, he was running an advertising agency, and he was also a musician, so my father played, and so he had multiple jobs. So I was very much latched to my whole childhood, mm-hmm. even living with my mother. And so when I got into school, my dad watching over my education wasn't the biggest, concern at the time. It was mainly survival. And so I went into high school, and I had all of these advanced classes my freshman year. And I remember going into, it was my freshman year, I had a biology class. I had never taken biology. I go into biology class. I think after that class, the first day I went to the school counselor and I found out that I could take animal science in the ag department and that would count for biology.
Oh,
so I got out of biology.
Course. Bingo. Yeah.
So I taught for almost 20 years in Christian classical schools. And so I used to tell my students, because they had all my high school students, they had to take biology, chemistry, physics, all these courses, calculus, pre-cal. And I was like, yeah, I never took any of those. So I was like, well, how did you do that? Well, in the state of California in the 1980s and 90s, I could take animal science and that counted in the ag department. And so I raised steers and went to the fair. That counted for my biology classes. And then and I didn't have to take any foreign languages. So my students always, and now I was a Latin teacher. But but there was a requirement where you had to take 2 years of a foreign language or a fine art, and woodshop counted as a fine art. So instead of Spanish, I took woodshop. So I got out, I lived in the ag department and the woodshop, and kind of my sophomore, junior, senior year, I was basically in shop class most of the time.
But now you're remodeling a house, and so all of this is very handy.
Yeah, well, it has come in handy for sure. Yeah, but so I did that, and so I went to California. My uncle was a welder. I wanted to weld, so I go out, study, do welding. While I was welding, I was working as a carpenter in North Dallas in Coppell. I was just down the road from the Cowboys training camp at the time. I don't know if they're still there, but I finished, and when I finished, I went back to California and decided not to weld. I went back to training horses because all through high school, my dad was a horse trainer. He worked for a dude ranch in Platina, California. It's called Our Wild Horse Dude Ranch. And so I started working with him and training horses. So I went back and started training horses for world champion reiners and cutters and stuff, cutting horses, competition horses. But you can't, it's just, to make a living like that, it's pretty tough. So at some point, I ended up going back to church because I haven't been going to church for most of this time of my youth. Ended up meeting my wife, and at that point I went back to school to Bible college in Northern California. When I had finished that, I moved to Massachusetts to seminary, where I studied theology and languages. So I would go over to the East Coast of Boston and come back to California to work, and that's when I got into education because our church had a school, and I started teaching in fifth grade. I was teaching fifth graders, all subjects in a small Christian school. And so we were there for a couple of years, and then we decided to move out of the state of California. And when we did, I took a job. I had two phone calls. I applied to about 20, 25 schools. I had one school in Maryland that called me, another one in New York City, Geneva School of Manhattan, and they offered me a job. So we moved. We had three children, and we moved to New York City, and for 3 years working there, which from there we came to North Carolina. So that's a long and short of it.
So when I met you in 2008, because we were in the apprenticeship together,
right.
We were in the same class. Andrew was our head mentor. I believe you had just moved to Manhattan. You hadn't been there very long. Mm-hmm. So at this point in your life, no more cowboy, no more rodeo. After high school, you didn't do rodeo anymore.
No, I rodeoed after high school in the amateur circuit, and then also in the PRCA as an amateur. The PRCA is a Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association, the NFR, Reno, mm-hmm. Nevada. People are probably somewhat familiar with it.
What was your event?
I was a saddle bronc rider at that time. In high school, I rode bulls, and I had an accident my freshman year. So I drew a bull. Red Bluff, California was the home of John Growney, Growney Brother Rodeo Company, Growney Brothers. And John Growney at the time owned a bull called Red Rock. And this was back in the 1980s. And there was something called the Challenge of the Champions. And at that time, Lane Frost was the world champion bull rider. Now, they made a movie on this called 8 Seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So for those who are familiar with this. And John Growney's in the movie and stuff. So, but my dad did the advertising for that in California. So it was the best out of seven. There were going to be seven rodeos. And it was, and Red Rock at that time was a bull that had gone out like something around 280 some odd attempts, and nobody had ever ridden Red Rock. But he was a docile bull in the sense that we used to go out to the Grounies, and kids from the school, the third graders and fourth graders, would come out, and he'd have some panels set up, and Red Rock would be in there, and John would be in there standing next to the bull, and the kids would come in, and he'd lift the kids and put them up on the bull. They'd take a picture of them, yes. Take them off, and put them. You just went through like 30, 40 kids,
yeah.
Just putting them up on, taking these pictures, and he would just stand there. But in the arena, he just turned into a bucking, really ranked bull, and nobody. Well, anyway, so Lane gets him. The first time Lane rides Red Rock was in Redding, California. I was there at that rodeo. It was a night rodeo. And we were filming it, and by the end of it, Lane Frost had ridden Red Rock 4 out of the 7 times. He's the only cowboy to have ever ridden him. And then they retired him, and so Red Rock was retired, and he was then a breeding bull. And so what would happen is the contractors would get these young bulls, and before they would put them into the professional circuit, they would try them out at the high school rodeos. So I was a freshman in high school. We had a high school rodeo in Cottonwood, California, and I drew a bull. It was called Wolfman Skull. And Wolfman Skull was the grandson of Red Rock.
Oh.
And he was a really small bull, and I drew him, and I still have it on video. My parents were recording it And anyway, so he threw me down and horned me twice behind the ear and fractured my skull. So knocked me out. I was out for a couple of days, ended up in the hospital, lost, you know, spinal fluid, fractured, busted the eardrum, all those things. And so that ended the bull riding. My dad was So from there I went to bucking horses. And so that which was safer.
And that's safer?
A little bit safer. They don't have horns.
They didn't have horns.
Did y'all wear helmets back then?
No. So the interesting thing is so all of that came right after that, shortly after that, this is in 1990. I think, right, 1990, and then Lane Frost in Cheyenne, Wyoming, had an accident and died. A bullet hooked him in the chest, and punctuated his lung, or heart, or something, and ended up dying. And after that, they made protective vests mandatory for all high school rodeos and bull riding. So, but this was right after I had finished doing riding bulls. So when I was riding, helmets and vests, and you just didn't see them. It was just guys going out there dressed, you know, just in a shirt, pants, chaps, and spurs, right? And so I never had to wear a vest. Now there was a little bit of a pride thing. It's like, yeah, I'm not going to use any protection. This is, you know, that's not the real cowboy. And then I rode, and then what happened was my senior year in high school with the rodeo, they made, the vests were mandatory for all bull riders. And then my senior year, they were making helmets mandatory for all bull riders, because I think shortly after that, Tough Hedeman was a world champion. He was a friend of Lane Frost, and he drew a bull called Bodacious, and he totally smashed his face has been totally reconstructed from this accident, nearly killed him. And so then they made helmets mandatory for high school rodeo. The year after I graduated in 93, they made vests mandatory for all rough stock riders. So I never had to wear a vest, even riding bucking horses. But now today in high school rodeo, it's mandatory that all rough stock cowboys wear protective vests, and which is a really good thing. So because it deflects the force of a hoof. You know, I've got scars on one on my head and one on my chin from being kicked in the face, you know, from horses and stuff, riding. But anyways, yeah.
So, okay, I'm sure we could draw a lot of conclusions about how being kicked in the face could prepare you to teach fifth graders. But how did that part of your life experience play into and affect what kind of teacher you are today?
Yeah, what led me into teaching, I think a lot of it was early on for Searcy, when I came to Searcy, I was this 2007, 2008, sometime around the end of the apprenticeship. And then at that time, I think there was a blog, and it was called Quiddity for Searcy. And I wrote an article way back then, and I called it The Round Pen. I remember writing that, because at that time there was MySpace, and I think I even had a MySpace, and I had written or My Journal or something like that.
Yeah, way back then.
And I had written this, that was the analogy. So I, for training horses, I worked in the round pen. I started all the babies, so the three-year-olds. And so before they would go off to the finished trainer, I would start them, and it was every horse goes through the round pen. So it's like kindergarten for horses, right? And so hundreds of horses that I trained over a series of 10, 15, 20 years. And what I realized in doing that was one of the pieces of advice my dad gave me was to take what you can use and throw out the rest, because every trainer has an idea about how to do it and how to train horses. And so I was working for a world champion trainer, and he taught me a lot. And so the round pen came a place with these horses where we'd start them, and we had to teach them all the fundamentals. So I had to teach a horse how to lope, how to stop, how to walk, how to position his body, how to twist, how to where to position his head, how to bend the neck, how to change leads, you know, how to move from a left lead to a right lead, and all these kinds of, it's so technical. There's so much technique in this, and that my job was to teach the horse all the fundamentals. And one of the things that I learned very quickly is that every single horse was different. They all had their own personality. It's very interesting. And so basically the way I described it was, I could not, there was no single technique that I could take and apply and it would work on every horse. So what I had to do was the basics, the fundamentals, and I had a goal that I had to get the horse to. But then I had to figure out, okay, so this horse's disposition, you know, his character or characteristics, and I had to figure out what worked best and how to get him from here to there. And so I had to adapt my training to the horse. And so I think for me, the round pen, you know, I was the sort of the teacher in the classroom, right? I was the one training, teaching in the round pen, and the horse was my student. And that was the parallel that I drew. And I think what led me into the classroom eventually was just that that was kind of the same thing. You know, I could come into a classroom and I had a goal, had a subject, whatever it was that I was teaching. And the task, the challenge was how to teach the students this, to get them from point A to point B. And anyways, that was the parallel that I had from it. For whatever reason, that seemed to work.
And then each student is different.
Right, yeah.
You're teaching the class as a whole, but you're paying attention to individual students just like...
Well, yeah, I mean, this is... right, not all the students are the same. You can't just... It's not a conveyor belt. They're not mechanical. And I think the Phaedrus in particular, this was one of the things that I loved the most about the Phaedrus when we read it in the apprenticeship. And at the end of it, there's a point where Socrates says that the task of the rhetor was to understand the nature of the subject and the nature of each individual soul, and then to bring those together. And it's like, that's exactly, like, that was it. And I think that's right. I mean, I use a basic technique for teaching Latin, but I have to be able to, I have to be able to read my students as well and figure out, okay, so how, like, you're struggling with this is not the same as a student over here struggling with another aspect of it. And obviously doing it the way we're doing it's not working. So how can we figure out to make it work? And so
tell me what you can say as an adult who learned Latin, not having grown up in Latin class your whole life. Mm-hmm. And you had to learn it as an adult, and then we have homeschool moms who want to teach classically and they don't know Latin. So what's it like, you know, we want to encourage them that yes, you can do this. Obviously you can join Buck's Latin apprenticeship and be immersed in it, but for someone who just like, hey, I'm out here and, you know, I want to learn Latin so I can teach my kids, what advice would you have for her?
Well, yeah, I think they're myths in some sense, this idea that somehow children are better at learning languages than adults. And there are differences for sure between how children learn and how adults learn and can approach. But yeah, I didn't come to Latin until I was in my 30s. And then I was pretty much an autodidact. I mean, I taught myself by picking up a book and I understand not, you know, this isn't, but I ended up taking classes later or studying under, you know, other gentlemen, other folks.
So you were learning it in order to teach it. So you were assigned, you're going to be teaching Latin, and you didn't know any Latin, so then you had to learn Latin.
And I knew that all I had to do was stay 1 or 2 days ahead of my students.
Right. We've been there. Yeah.
There were times where some of the students knew more than me. And I got checked a lot, you know, so it's not that, but it took years. It's not, I mean, I taught for 13 years at the school in North Carolina that I was at, and where I accepted the job. And so I was there 13 years. So, and to get to now where I am now, it's not like it happened overnight. I mean, but I'm in the classroom 5 days a week teaching 3 or 4 classes a day. And I think it's hard. I don't pretend that learning a language is easy. It's not. It's very hard. And so I don't know the advice. I mean, I think the thing is that it's possible. It's like once you're an adult, it's all over and there's no hope you can't possibly learn language. I don't think so. I think you most certainly can. But then again, it's like, well, what's the goal? Is the goal... I mean, I grew to love Latin. I didn't love it for a long time. I had opportunities while I was in school to take it, and I'm like, nah, I don't want to learn Latin. I'm not interested. And so, but it wasn't until I actually started studying it that I actually fell in love with it. And not all people are language people. I understand that. You know, even my students, you know, not all my students are going to love the language. And as much as my goal is to help you learn to love the language, I realize that that's not going to happen. So, but there's the value and the beauty of it is there. But what's the advice? I think it's, you know, I think with learning the language, one of the things that we focus on, this would be an assessment issue. And I think when we talk about language, and there's two things. One, the goals, why is it being taught? And secondly, assessment is important because the way that we teach the language is so that we can assess it. In other words, in language, there are three actual things that take place when you're learning the language. But two of them in particular is we think of it in terms of the four language arts that we reading, writing, speaking, and listening. And two of those are passive and two of them are active. So reading and listening are passive. Those are activities where the language is coming in, right? That we're receiving it. And then writing and speaking are active. That's where the language is being produced. So there's a difference between receiving the language versus producing the language. All of assessment when it comes down to language learning is based on language production. Mm-hmm. So the only way that we assess language is based on what the student writes or tells us. So it's all based on producing language. Mm-hmm. That is the most difficult aspect of language and is the last thing to come. So it's like, and so in other words, the way we approach it in terms of our teaching is that we take the most difficult thing first. And then we use that in order to assess our children on the language, and it's difficult. It's a struggle. It's very hard, and it's also not really a good indicator of how much language they have acquired, because if you've ever had this experience of having a thought or an understanding and then the difficulty of trying to communicate it, like we have that all the time, and just because I have just because I have a difficulty in trying to communicate something doesn't mean that I don't understand something.
I mean, even with little kids, their receptive vocabulary is much greater than their expressive vocabulary. They can understand a whole lot more than they can put into words.
And so I think one of the things that we've been talking about, Matt and I, in particular, Matt Bianco, is that the way that we should think about maybe assessing language is rather than thinking of it in terms of the language production, which is called output, think about it in terms of input. And so making language, not necessarily making it fun, but taking the, one of the things some theorists talk about is what's called an effective filter. And an effective filter is that things like stress end up causing barriers to actual, and I don't think this happens maybe just with language, it could happen with particularly any subject.
Math.
Well, frustration, confusion, stress ends up throwing up a barrier that then makes it impossible to move forward. And so my goal as a teacher was always, how can I remove the stress, right? How can I? And so there were several things that I did in the classroom that I believe was removing those barriers, taking the stress off, and saying, my interest is here is to engage the language and enjoy it and to see it. And I'm not here to stress you out. So I tried to remove stress and fear in the classroom.
How did you do that? Like, besides saying, don't be stressed, like, did you use it to play games with them? Like, did you eliminate some of the assessments that are tests and say, you know, I think that in the younger grades, they don't need a grade for language, but I know sometimes they're required.
Right. Yeah. And so that raises up a number of questions. I agree. In fact, why we grade the language, I'm not even sure. But we could think about if you have to put a mark down, we could put some kind of mark. We could figure out ways to do this. But practically, yeah. So every Friday, my class was basically a game. I'd bring my guitar. We would do songs. Now, the songs that I was singing were also classic. Many of them were classic medieval and classical Roman songs. Catullus, Tibullus, Carmina Burana, and some of the, like some of these you would probably know if I you know I sang them. But I would, so I bring my guitar. The kids loved it. Like Friday was like we just do songs or we would play games. As far as homework went, you know, this is a whole issue. You know, brick and mortar school, I always had a hard time with this. The kids are there working 35 hours a week, and then we give them a double shift when they go home.
That's why people homeschool.
And it's like, why do I don't even want to go home and work a double shift. Why would I make my students do it? And so, and there's always these battles about homework and stuff. So I said, yeah, forget the homework. What I asked the students to do was 20 minutes of reading. Like they spent, so when basically it wasn't even graded, so I stopped grading homework for one. And I really, in terms of assigning homework, my assignment was time-based. I wanted to spend 20 minutes listening. I mean, and I think that's actually more important than anything, rather than doing exercises or anything else. And now there's so much audio that's available that you can listen to. And plus the curriculum we're using there was audio that was associated with it. So I want you
to listen. What were you using when you were teaching Latin?
Well, at first we were using a program called Cambridge.
Yeah.
But then we moved to Lingua Latina, which is what I've been teaching since, I think, 2016.
Lingua Latina. So that seems like a curriculum good for homeschoolers. Is that one of the stories?
Yes. It's the thing about Lingua Latina, though, I think it's the best curriculum out there, but it requires... You can teach it, but the way that it's written is that it is written to engage the language fully and actively. And the temptation is if you don't, as a teacher, if you don't have it down well enough to present it that way, the temptation is to default back and go back into a mode where you're just translating sentences.
Right.
And so I really moved completely and entirely away from that. I never have my students translate anything. But because again, that's the hardest thing to do, because if you think about it, to translate a sentence, you actually have to know two languages. You have to know the language that you're translating into, and you have to know the language that you're translating from. And in order to do that well, you have to actually have mastered both languages. And so then the question is, well, how can you tell if they understand without translating? Well, there are ways of doing that, but I mean, so anyhow, the thing is moving away from that. And so Lingua Latina could be done well, but I think it does require some help and assistance on like how can we do this.
So are there online, like, so that a mom who wants their children to learn that way, are there online programs that they can plug into? Because if the mom doesn't know it.
Yeah, there is. And there's other things out there too. I usually play, there's two in particular that I typically play. I mean, Pictodicta is out there as
Pictodicta.
Roman Rhodes
publishes
it. And Ruben Jensen was one of the ones that I think started writing that. And so that's intended as a primer for Lingua Latina. Like it's written with Lingua Latina in mind. Mm. The other program is Dr. Laura Eyte out at Dallas University, and she has, I think it's something like Latin Story Time or something. I can't remember the actual name of it right now, but she's been writing a curriculum for Latin for elementary level, and it's much of it is encountering the language through pictures, through song, through. What's called TPR, total physical response, where, you know, there's one little, it's funny because I taught a song last year at the Bidwin, and Dr. Eyte was there, and the song was Flebat Lepus, and which is going to be a song in the book that we have coming out with the Latin Song and Games, but we did that song, and then I was looking back on the website again at their curriculum, and she has a recording there's a recording of a young girl, 5 or 6, and she's got a little stuffed bunny, and she's singing Flebat Lepus, and in part of which means the wailing bunny is kind of what it's a rabbit hunt. It's a medieval song, And there's parts of it where it describes the parts of the rabbit where it says, you know, the rabbit has long ears and a short tail. And the little girl, when it comes to the part, longa salvare, so she grabs the ear, she holds it up, you know, and brevis cauda, so, you know, a short tail, and she points to the tail, and then a big jump, and she's making this big jump. So in other words, that's total physical response, where she's hearing the words and she's associating the words with the action that they relate to. And so they're learning through not just reading or translating, but they're learning through hearing and physical, like they're using the senses.
Yeah, what a great way to engage.
I love that.
Several senses.
Yeah, so I think those are ways that I think you start moving away from getting the stress out of the classroom and enjoying the language and encountering the language poetically is really what we're talking about, a poetic knowledge of the language. Yeah.
So I have one more question. Time's nearly up, but the mom who has boys and they just want to be outside and just to drag them in and they want to get their work done as soon as they can, and maybe they don't do a good job because they want to get outside. Encourage that mother.
Oh, thanks.
I mean, I know you had girls, but you also had a farm.
I love girls, but I raised them like boys.
One of them told me that.
One of my dogs, I think all three of them could actually go out, catch a chicken, and then take it from the pen and put it on the table. So it's like, they know the whole process. Part of it is a sense of my own life. While my dad was not, my parents by no, my dad by no means hovered, you know, was over me watching all of my work and stuff. But what he did encourage me was a lot was through rodeo in particular. He was always there. He took me to all my rodeos. And we spent a lot of time outside doing stuff. And, you know, I know our time's running, but a funny story was when we moved to North Carolina the first time, we lived out, the house was on 27 acres. It was a field, farm field, where the school owned the property, was going to build the school. And right next to it were some woods. Now, that was kind of a weird concept because out west, woods meant like a whole forest. But, you know, here it can be like a little one acre thing. It's called woods. And so our girls at that time were outside. And I think our oldest was in fifth grade. So it was like fifth grade, third grade, kindergarten. And they're all outside playing on these 27 acres. And the next thing we knew, a sheriff car came up, pulled up in our driveway. And we're like, what's going on? Dude, we just came out of New York City where we, like, all they had was a sidewalk, you know? Now it's like freedom. And they're running all over the 27 acres, coming in and out of woods. Well, somebody had seen these three kids coming in and out of these woods, and they called the sheriff. And the sheriff came out to check on us. And we're like, because they were playing outside, you know, and it's kind of funny because you think, I don't know that I see kids outside like they were when I was a kid, you know?
Yeah.
And so he was telling stories about his mom used to lock the door and wouldn't let him come back in until dinner, you know, the sheriff. He was a pretty nice guy, but there's a part of me that says that part of childhood, like there has to be the play, but it doesn't mean that they're not going to. You know, not everybody goes into their 30s and decides to pick up another, you know, language and then ends up studying Latin. I get that.
And Hebrew, you know, Hebrew fluently as well.
So, biblical languages. But those were, you know, I don't know what happened. Those are just decisions. You know, my brothers didn't follow that same course, you know, and we grew up together. And they, you know, they work in a factory right now is what they do, you know. And I think maybe tastes, like, you know, there has to be things that, and I think it's really the idea of wonder too. It's like there has to be some encounter with something beautiful about language, or whether maybe it is just the songs, you know, maybe it is like they've learned this fun song and that sticks with them. And 10 years from now, they decide, you know what, that somehow they stumble across Catullus again in a different setting, and it sparks an interest that takes them back into Latin and, you know, or whatever it may be. So, I don't know.
It's the power of the true, the good, and the beautiful, you know, to form a life.
Well, and in particular, beauty, I think. Yeah. That encounter of beauty is that which that draws us into, because beauty is alarming and in one sense, and also mysterious. And it's, I think, that encounter with something that's inviting, but yet not fully understood, is what draws us to want to pursue it further.
It opens the door to the transcendent.
Yeah, right.
Well, thank you for being here with us. It was really fun to all be in one room and re-talking about these things. And so for our listeners, if you're interested in the apprenticeship or the Latin apprenticeship, there's lots of information on our website. You can contact us. And
we also have the summer intensive.
What is your email? Tell everybody your email.
Buck. Buck, B-U-C-K, at CerseiInstitute.org.
So thank you for being with us.
Sure.
And here's to home.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.